From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In early 2011, the Arab Spring took hold in Libya, with thousands taking to the streets to protest Muammar Gaddafi, who had led the country for 40 years. A crackdown by Gaddafi's security forces led to a civil war that lasted for more than 8 months, with an estimated 9,000 people killed and thousands more injured. The civil war ended after the death of Gaddafi in October 2011, and for a few years, there was relative peace in Libya. That is, until 2014. That's when a second civil war broke out between competing militias. That's killed more than 4,500 people. That battle divided the country with competing parliaments in both the West in Tripoli and in the East. Now a UN-backed unity government has been set up in neighboring Tunisia, and that unity government just moved to Tripoli in recent days, but is struggling to exert authority. Adding to the problem is ISIS, which has gained power in the country and decimated Libya's economy, attacking oil ports and trying to expand its control in the region. Today on Global Journalist, a look at how Libya has come apart at the seams and how it may be put back together. We've got a packed show, so let's get straight to our first guest. Joining us from Rome is Nancy Porcia, a journalist who is based in Libya and reported for a number of news outlets, including Deutsche Welle and Sky Italy. Nancy, welcome to Global Journalist.
Welcome to you.
Nancy, tell us just a little bit about, take us back, if you would. Libya was in the headlines in 2011 during the Arab Spring. Then it kind of fell out of sort of the news for a lot of people in the West. Tell us what happened in 2014 to get us to the point we're at today.
Well, just after the revolution, it seemed for a while that the transitional phase was actually going to succeed. There were the international community was supporting the post-revolutionary authorities, and the fights and the clashes going on all across the country were with a very low intensity. So there was a high hope for about 2 years. Throughout 2012, but just by the end of 2013, the first failure of the post-revolutionary Libya start to emerge. Basically, in mid 2013, a law called political isolation law was passed by the Congress. According to this law, all the high-ranked officers with Gaddafi regime were banned from any governmental position, and they were then sacked from the Congress.
And so why was this significant that people who had worked in Gaddafi's regime were banned from working in the post-revolutionary government?
It was a try to keep away from the new Libya all people involved with the Gaddafi regime. But let's say that there were two different schools about this political isolation law that represents a very kind of turning point in the new Libya. According to some Libyans, according to some analyzers from the international community, the people working with Gaddafi regime were actually the skillful people able to drag the country out of the crisis started after the revolution. According to some others, this law was actually the only instrument to guarantee a new path for Libya out of far away from the Gaddafi people, Gaddafi followers' interests. So just after the political isolation law was passed on May 2013, all people banned from the government, just like the president of the Congress, Magariev, were replaced by members, MPs that have never been elected. Following this step, the Muslim Brotherhood Party, the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Libya, was accused to infiltrate to sneak inside the Congress. So there was plus beside the accusation against the Muslim Brotherhood party inside the Congress, also the on the ground, on the military ground, two blocks started to emerge.
And so this is where we started to see the division of the country then between this group in the east, the Eastern House of Representatives government, and then sort of this self-declared government in Tripoli then.
Well, back then it was mainly between the city of Misrata and the city of Zintan, because the city of they are both considered the main revolutionary cities in Libya, but the Zintan, which is in the west as well as Misrata, were divided ideologically. Zintan was not with the Muslim Brotherhood, while Misrata was closer to Muslim Brotherhood. Doesn't mean that the whole Misrata was with the Muslim Brotherhood, but the leadership of Muslim Brotherhood was very close to Misrata revolutionary forces. So the country, the second, let's say, the counterpart of the Muslim Brotherhood bloc, called for new parliamentary elections in 2014. So in these elections led to the second parliament, which is the House of Representatives, on June 2014, just after the elections of the new parliament. The outgoing Congress decided for a lack of trust towards the members and the, let's say, the lobby backing the new parliament, to step back. That from that time we had two parliaments, one Congress in Tripoli and one House of Representatives in the Far East city of Tobruk.
And this is what left us with a divided country. We do have just a few seconds left, Nancy. You live in Libya. Tell us just a little bit about people's daily lives there. How have they changed as a result of this sort of power vacuum?
I would say that people in Libya have learned a lot. Although the country lacks of security, although the situation is absolutely unclear, still Libyans managed to get familiar with the politics. They learned that there is no one party, there is no one regime. So they went through this kind of political process political, reaching the political awareness. And nowadays, yes, they are aware that they might choose their leader, but due to the financial crisis, due to the economical crisis on the ground, after the international community left the country because of the civil war, they don't really, they are completely hopeless. They don't really endorse anybody, anyone of the government. They just hope that the international community gets back to boost the local economy. The only thing that does really matter for the Libyan people in the streets, is the exchange rate of the Libyan currency in the black market.
Well, Nancy, I'm going to have to stop you there because we do have a packed show here, but thank you so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thanks to you for inviting.
A reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Global Journalist. This week, a look at the ongoing conflict in Libya and whether or not the country can recover. We're going to take a broader look at the political crisis in Libya now. Joining us to discuss from London, Mohamed Mahdi, a reporter for BBC News. Also from London, Jason Pack, a writer and researcher on Libya at Cambridge University, and he has also founded a consulting group called Libya Analysis. From Paris, Mary Fitzgerald, a correspondent who previously covered Libya for the Irish Times. She was also a contributing author to the book The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath. Welcome to all of you. Mohamed Mahdi, you've covered Libya for some time. I understand you have family in Libya as well. Can you give us just a sense as to how everyday life has changed for Libyans as a result of there being no sort of functioning central government?
Well, remarkably, I think what's remarkable about this situation is that Libyans have adapted to the fact that in some places of the country there is no government, and in some places it's contested. It's just become a fact of life for them. So people are, as much as possible, trying to get on with their daily lives. People are still graduating. People are still getting married. People are still opening businesses as best they can, even in the complete absence of any kind of overarching authority. So that's what I think is remarkable. And despite the kind of the fact that Libya is awash with weapons now, with so many armed groups, it's surprising that violence, intercommunal violence, isn't actually higher.
And Jason Pack, in the news about Libya over the past week has been the arrival of this United Nations-backed unity government in Tripoli, if you will. What can you tell us about the significance of that?
Well, to stress points made both by Nancy and by Mohammed, in 2014, we saw the emergence of a split between Tobruk and Tripoli, which, yes, of course, dated back to the 2013 political isolation law. You could see the fissure in the society as those who wanted complete lustration. And lustration is the word here, meaning anyone associated with the former regime is unable to have a political role. Think of de-Ba'athification in Iraq, and we know all the cleavages that that brought about. There have been UN attempts to mediate between the Tobruk and Tripoli-based groups, the lustration and anti-lustration groups. I believe those efforts were corrupted. The former UN envoy, Bernardino León, a Spanish politician, was very much implicated in receiving bribes from the United Arab Emirates. And as a result, this UN process petered on for 18 months, didn't really culminate in unifying any of the sides. It succeeded in creating a third government, which also controls no territory, and it has now imposed that government on Libya. Well, fortunately, despite the fact that the GNC, or self-declared Tripoli government, forbid the UN-backed government from landing in Libya, it was able to arrive by boat. There hasn't been too much civil conflict among competing militias in Tripoli at present. That's a great success. This government is able to walk around the UN government in Tripoli and to conduct meetings, but it would be incorrect to say that it's a unity of various parties or that it is widely popular. It has its supporters, it has its opponents. None of the supposed three governments in Libya have any sovereignty at all. It's the local militias and local councils which control the country, and there is no sovereignty in Libya.
Well, let me toss this to Mary Fitzgerald then, because Libya is a significant oil exporter. Who controls Libya's oil now, and who controls its central bank and its financial reserves?
Well, who controls the oil has been a vexed question since 2011, given that those who protect the oil facilities in different parts of the country are essentially militias and have used their control over oil facilities to try and gain political leverage over the last 5 years. Right now, you have the National Oil Corporation and the Central Bank headquarters in Tripoli, both of which have insisted they have remained neutral despite the political power struggle of the last 2 years. The UN resolution recently that recognized that unity government that's trying to take shape right now is the sole legitimate authority in Libya. It also recognized the NOC, that is the National Oil Corporation, the Central Bank in Tripoli, as the institutions, the recognized institutions. There are parallel institutions in eastern Libya claiming to be legitimate National Oil Corporation or the Central Bank. So that has been part of the political power struggle over the last 2 years. What the Western powers are hoping is this unity government process, fragile and all as it is, will put an end to that question of parallel institutions. They're also hoping that as the unity government process continues, this question of the armed groups protecting the oil facilities, that this will be addressed in the long term as well. But I think if we're to give your readers an overview of what led Libya to the crisis point it finds itself in today, we mustn't forget the role of Khalifa Haftar, the former Gaddafi general, who joined the uprising against Gaddafi in 2011. But in February 2014, was accused of attempting a coup against the then government. Later in May, he declared a so-called war on terrorism in the eastern city of Benghazi, which gained a considerable amount of popular support given the assassinations and bombings that had been plaguing Benghazi. Extremist groups in the city were accused of carrying this out. But Haftar was, at that point, declaring the Muslim Brotherhood as his main enemy, forces aligned to him attacked the then elected parliament in Tripoli. And all of that kind of created a dynamic, a certain dynamic in Western Libya. There were several elements that believed Haftar was using this war on terrorism, as he declared it, as a pretext, and that his ultimate aim was a power grab.
Well, let me throw this to Mohamed Mahdi then, because you do raise the role of General Haftar. I understand he's actually an American citizen, and he is part of this Eastern-backed government. There has been this narrative in the media about Libya as sort of a battleground between Islamists and secularists. Is that sort of the right way to look at this conflict?
There are several ways of looking at it. I mean, certainly there were splits within the GNC in early days between Islamists and liberals, although that too is quite a simplistic way of looking at it. I think the point that Jason made about lustration versus non-lustration parties, that's also a significant cleavage. In Libya, there isn't a major sectarian cleavage as we've had in other countries like Iraq, so that has thankfully not been a problem. But despite that, the country has fragmented into several parts, each controlled by different factions.
And Mohammed,
despite the fact that largely Libya is a Sunni, mostly Arab, 10% ethnic minorities country.
Tell us about the role, Mohammed, of the Islamic State in Libya, because obviously this has been a particular focus of the international community.
It has. So Islamic State has, in Libya, probably its largest outpost in North Africa. And many analysts have said that IS commanders in Syria and Iraq are now viewing Libya, cities like Sirte and villages outside Sirte, as a kind of bolt hole. So if everything goes wrong for them in Syria and Iraq, if they're pushed back, their commanders may be planning to fly there and set up shop in Sirte to lay low for a while because of the vast ungoverned spaces around there. But they have been pushed out of several cities in Libya. For example, in Derna, where they had a presence last year, they were pushed out by other Islamist militias. They have been fighting wars on both fronts against the Eastern government and the Western government. So in a sense, both sides have unified against the common threat of Islamic State, as have international actors such as the US, which last month launched airstrikes against a cell, an Islamic State cell in Sabratha.
I want to remind our listeners there. Tuned into Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the ongoing conflict in Libya and if the country can recover. Our guest this week from London, Mohamed Mahdi, a reporter for the BBC. Also from London, Jason Pack, a Libya researcher at Cambridge University, founder of LibyaAnalysis.com. And from Paris, Mary Fitzgerald, a journalist and contributor to the book The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Jason Pack in London, tell us, if you would, why is it that ISIS has been able to establish such a strong foothold in Libya that they're looking at it as sort of this last redoubt, potentially, where their leaders could flee from Iraq or Syria?
Briefly put, Libya has been a power vacuum since the revolution against Gaddafi succeeded. There was not as much violence in 2012 and 2013 as there has been since 2014, but there's never been sovereign authority. And as a result, you have a situation in which local communities govern themselves, and local militias are the law of the land. They incarcerate people, they put them in detentions, they raid homes of former Gaddafi officials and seize their property. This is the ideal petri dish, you might say, for the growth of the microorganism that is the Islamic State. It breeds on chaos and a power vacuum. As we heard from Mohammed, the Islamic State initially established itself in 2014 in Derna, an eastern city traditionally associated with jihadism and many returnees from Iraq. However, due to conflicts with other jihadi militias in Derna, it sought Sirte, a city in the center of the country, Gaddafi's former birthplace, and a city that has suffered greatly in the upheaval of the revolution, to make its nest in Libya. I would agree with everything that Mohammed has said about the Islamic State, but disagree with his rather, in my mind, optimistic comment that the Eastern and Western authorities have begun to work together against the Islamic State. I see quite a different reality. To go back to Mary's very good point, General Haftar declared first a coup in 2014 and then a self-proclaimed war on terror. He hasn't really pursued that war on terror. He hasn't fought the Islamic State. He's tried to fight his opponents in Misrata, and in western Libya. And similarly, the Misratins, rather than really fighting the Islamic State and taking the threat seriously, have tried to fight General Haftar. So you have a three-partite civil war, and American or Western airstrikes have only made the matter worse.
Well, this is it is a very complex
Islamic State is a coalition.
It is a very complex conflict. And Mary, we did hear Jason just raise airstrikes by the United States. There have been reports that France has also launched air attacks there. What is the future of that? Were those one-off attacks, or are we likely to see more sort of foreign military intervention in Libya?
Well, there's been an ongoing debate about possible Western intervention, or expanded, I should say, Western intervention in Libya. The U.S. has acknowledged it carried out airstrikes some late last year, which allegedly killed the then leader of Islamic State in Libya, and others earlier this year around the town of Sabratha, killing dozens of mostly Tunisian members of Islamic State. Right now, we hear from some Western capitals drumbeats of possible future expanded intervention, whether we're talking about an expanded aerial campaign accompanied by some form of ground forces. There are already Western special forces on the ground in various parts of Libya, trying to liaise with local armed groups, trying to kind of knit together an anti-Islamic State front. But this is fraught with all kinds of risks, because already you have, even within communities, rivalries between different local militias. So inserting Western special forces into environments like that, where they're trying to assess who would be their best partner in the battle against Islamic State, you know, it's quite obvious that this is going to be very, very fraught indeed, and risks exacerbating those existing tensions and rivalries. So I think some Western capitals are weighing this up very carefully. They're aware of the risks. Others are more gung-ho, we might say. They feel that Islamic State in Libya is gaining ground, expanding its presence. And I think there are all kinds of anxieties in certain European capitals about the presence of Islamic State in Libya, given its proximity to Europe and the possibility of an attack in Europe launched or planned from Libya. I think if such a scenario occurred, then that would up the stakes considerably.
And Mohamed Mahdi, I do understand that Libya has been a launching point for a number of people on this migration route from Africa to Europe, even though much of the news lately has been about Greece and Turkey. How has sort of the power vacuum there played into this sort of black market economy that exists now in Libya?
Well, it's been a smugglers' and human traffickers' paradise, really. Vast ungoverned space, many willing migrants willing to take the risky journey across the sea to Europe. The fact that it lies very, very close to islands like Malta and Lampedusa, where migrants can easily land. It has been a smugglers' paradise, and people have been trying to take advantage of those people's intentions.
There was one other point I also wanted to raise with you about this power vacuum. I understand that actually your grandmother had some problems with her home in Libya. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I mean, one of the downsides of not having functioning authorities, even at the municipal level, is that there's no things that we take for granted, like rubbish collection, like planning permission. All of that is very difficult to achieve. And members of my own family, including my grandma, the house that I used to visit as a child on summer holidays, this was undermined by construction work going on next door, which literally undermined the house, and bits of it started to cave in to the cavity that was next door, and so they were forced to move out. And so that's just one example of how lack of planning, lack of authority can affect normal everyday people.
And there's sort of limited repercussions then in an environment where there isn't a functioning local authority.
Exactly.
Well, Jason Pack, let me turn it to you, because you have been critical of international media coverage of Libya. What do you see as sort of problematic about how international news reporters have been covering this conflict?
Well, in the United States, since 2012, when my friend, our ambassador, Christopher Stevens, was killed in Benghazi, the American media has been drawn into the Republican Party's desire to use that event in a partisan conflict against Hillary Clinton. And therefore, what happens in Libya is obscured based on the partisan attempts to use Libya to hurt Hillary in her attempt to gain the Democratic nomination to become president. And therefore, you have coverage on, oh, should we have intervened? Should we not have intervened? And not focus on the real issues, what to do now about the growth of the Islamic State, what to do now about the fact that the UN has been corrupt in trying to impose a unity government and we have no unity between the different parties in Libya. Those are the real issues that are going to be affecting Western security, the flow of migrants, the corruption of billions of dollars of sovereign wealth. And this isn't going anywhere. It's only going to get worse as we approach the general election, and particularly with the Trump nominee on the Republican side. You're going to hear the word Libya used as a curse word and Benghazi used as a shorthand for incompetence. I actually don't believe that we intervened in Libya in 2011. We supported a popular movement and acceded to the wishes of the Arab League and the UN in supporting it with a no-fly zone. So the point is, the question of our actions in Libya have been so politicized that people don't have a grasp of what did happen in 2011. Rather, they have been sucked into this Hillary bashing.
Well, Mary Fitzgerald, let me turn this to you then, because the situation does sound not all that hopeful in some ways. Where do you see Libya 3 years from now?
Well, it's very difficult to predict where Libya may be in 3 months from now, let alone three years. I think in the next weeks, there are three key questions to look out for. Number one, the question of whether that UN-backed presidency council can consolidate its position in Tripoli, the capital, and gain control over the key institutions and ministries there. There's also, secondly, there's the question of whether that House of Representatives based in Tobruk, which is the elected parliament, whether they will actually vote to approve that government of UN-backed government of national accord, as they are supposed to do under the political agreement underpinning it. Number three, the question of what happens with Khalifa Haftar, that controversial general I mentioned earlier. Haftar was appointed commander-in-chief of the armed forces allied with the Eastern government. It was a controversial choice because he's an extremely polarizing figure in Libya. And the House of Representatives, or elements in the House of Representatives in Tobruk, are insisting that they will only approve that UN-mediated political agreement if an article in that agreement related to the army leadership, and that is the article that anti-Haftar elements see as their way of removing Haftar from the post. The House of Representatives elements within it are insisting that that article be removed if they are to approve the agreement. So those are the three questions we should look out for in the next weeks. Beyond that, it's very difficult to predict what way things may go. Libya is a very, very unpredictable place indeed.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Many thanks to Nancy Portia, Mohammed Mahdi, Jason Peck, and Mary Fitzgerald. Our executive producer is Joshua Kranzberg. Our supervising producer this week is Lakshna Mehta, with assistant producers Liying Kwan, Louise Hemmerly, and Riley Began. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBI. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.